There was a wise Indian man, last century, Nisargadatta Maharaj. Some of you know that name. He wrote a book, at least a book of his sayings was published in the West 15 years ago called I Am That, black and yellow book. Some of you may know the book. He said, when I see with wisdom, I am nothing. When I see with love, I am everything. Between the two, my life flows. So there is this, for those of you who are familiar with it, the Vipassana practice, a wisdom practice, a practice of training the mind to steady the gaze, to be able to see the deep truths of how things are, what really is and what really isn't, the delusion of the ego and the anxieties and extra things that the ego does to try and be happy that are wheel spinning and exhausting and often futile. And then there's the side of love, the metta side, the side of connecting, the side of being everything, one with everything. They're saying the same thing. When the ego is seen through, the separate sense of self isn't there. There isn't any such thing. There just is life. There is everything. There is not one me separated from you out there in deep truth. So whether you see that from wisdom, whether you see that from love, when you see it from a point of view of love, everything's interconnected with everything. It's saying the same thing. It's a different way of approaching it. Vipassana is one way of approaching reality, seeing clearly, insight, meditation, training. And the other is actually connecting with everything, opening the heart to and connecting with everything. They're just different doorways to the same reality. But they need each other. It's also said that wisdom without love isn't actually wisdom at all. It may be some degree of clarity, but it can be quite aloof or quite cool, quite disconnected. And love with no wisdom isn't actually love. It's attachment and desire and excitement and longing and all kinds of other things. But without the perspective of seeing the deep truths, it's a small version of love. They need each other. We call these two wings. There's many teachings which go together in these teachings of the Buddha, but these are two major wings that need each other to fly. One without the other, you can't fly. And it's also a deep truth which needs to be realized, which to be said is just words, but when we realize it, loving is the most normal thing possible. Anything that gets in the way of our loving is our disease, is our problem, is our struggle. And so the journey that we're on, the journey that anyone seeking deep truth, any kind of spiritual understanding is seeking, is the normal natural feeling of not being disconnected, of not being what we in Buddhism talk about as being covered up. Like my normal experience, my typical unwise experience, is as though I'm covered over by distorted lenses. Let's get rid of those lenses. Uncover. So when I see, I don't see clearly what's there. I see it with a particular overlay, my own story, my own experience, my own desires. And so I'm not really seeing that clearly. And the practice is this purification we often talk about, uncovering what's covered. And what's left when we uncover the distortions and the perversions and the versions of reality which are my own particular take, my own particular spin. When they're not there, the sense of me is quieted down or is abandoned for a while. The feeling of being connected with everything else is the most normal kind of feeling. It isn't bells on and Hollywood, bright lights flashing. It's just the absence of the angst that keeps me separate. The absence of the spin, which is my version of reality, my storytelling, my particular dramas. It's an absence of it. So there's a quiet naturalness of being at one with everything. And metta loving kindness is that expression. So it isn't, that's why I don't like to use the word love, because so often love for us is often a major perversion of reality. It's actually a lot of rose color to the glasses and a lot of want and desire and excitement and stimulus and all kinds of other things, which feel great. It's not bad. But it isn't actually the love of the Buddha. It's not the spiritual love, which is, that's why I hesitate to use that word, because it's got so many connotations in our society, in our language. So when I use that word, and we often use this word friendliness, it's the natural friendliness when you're not set apart from anybody or against anyone, or you don't have any judgments about anybody. You're kin when you've got a healthy relationship, which says a lot. Many of us don't have with our own kin, but when you're with another being where there's not a sense of ego, there's just familiarity and comfort and ease, that's the feeling. There's no need to be me and be seen to be me and explain myself. It's an absence of all that effort. So it's a relaxed, comfortable openness. And this is our true nature. So the practice, all of the trainings of all of the spiritual paths, I'm not familiar with lots and lots and lots at all, but are leading in the direction of being able to feel this natural feeling. The way one hand, if you hurt your hand, your other hand just like immediately is there for that hand. Doesn't have to sort of like wonder whether it should, you know, or do it because it's wise. It just cares for it. Or another way it's described is we feed ourselves. Our hands take food and put them in our mouths. There isn't a lot of effort or planning or trying to do it right. We just care. It's the most natural part of ourselves. We're like that. And these other parts that are guarded and worried and judging and comparing and everything is extra, on top, covering. And when in those moments when we don't do that extra, what's left is metta. So it's not something to get, as Joanne said today. We're not trying to create something or acquire something or find something at the end of the rainbow. What we're learning, of course, is what we do to stop it, what the coverings are all about. And we can learn that both in Vipassana, clearly seeing the comings and goings and shenanigans of the mind. And we can also in metta see when our heart feels open and connected and flowing and when it doesn't. And when there comes doubt or worry or fear or anxiety or boredom or all the other things that we've experienced today, as well as their absence. As a teacher, I quote many times Ajahn Sumedho, American monk, lives in England in his 70s now. He says that love is wisdom's natural radiance. And I like that word, radiance. We just radiate a sense of friendliness when there's wisdom. And many of you have heard me say this many times. The reason we like wise people isn't because of their wisdom. It's because they're so friendly. Because they're so easy to be with. They're so accessible and open. And the Dalai Lama says something like, when I meet people, I feel like they're my best friend. It's what happens when there is an openness, which is what happens when there is understanding and wisdom. They're each other's wing. In fact, the Buddha talked about metta, loving kindness, as one of four divine states. States of when we're in a divine state, when we're in an awakened moment, we're in one of four of these expressions happening. One is this one, loving kindness. Next one is compassion, which is exactly the same thing, but it's what responds when there's unhappiness or struggle, pain, suffering, compassion. There's mudita or empathetic joy or appreciative joy, which is what metta does when it's in the presence of loveliness. Some of you may have had a feeling of mudita walking in the beauty today, for instance. That's mudita, joy. Empathetic joy, connected joy. And the last one is equanimity, upekkha, a sense of vast, steady, understanding the whole picture, seeing why things are the way they are. It's the phrase, of course, of course that's why it's like this. I understand that. These are the four divine abidings, and the Buddha called them abidings, meaning this is our home. This is our natural way of being. This is home for us to feel this way. It's not strange to us that we have to go out and get and crank up. We do, we learn this practice, we try this practice to develop and incline ourselves, but what we're inclining ourselves to is what's actually already here. It's home. Friendliness is so natural. I like, and I've been saying this more recently, I heard this from an English scholar teacher who says that the language of Pali, in which the Buddha's teachings are recorded and have been translated from this language Pali, in its construction as a language, it's got way more verbs than the English language, which is much more noun-based. And so oftentimes in translating the teachings of the Buddha, I like thinking of them in terms of verbs. So metta we think of as a noun, or at least an adjective, loving kindness, a thing, to get, to have, to like, to want. It's actually more a verb of befriending. It's a way we function. It's not an object to achieve, to chase after, a goal. It's just a behavior of caring. When we go through our lives, when we go through our days, and we meet people, encounter people, there's a caring living. That's really what metta's like. Caring for the other because there's space in our hearts for the other. And that's when we're covered up with our own concerns and our self-worries and our doubts about ourselves and all of the things that upset us. We don't actually have that much space for anybody else. We meet somebody who's troubled and they just want to talk about their troubles and they don't really care. They never think of saying, and how are you? We know what that's like. We do that too. And it's because that person at that moment, us or whoever the other person is, hasn't got the space for someone else because they're at the moment upset and crying like a crying baby, needing attention, needing nourishment. But when that crying baby is soothed and fine and calm, it's available. It's open. That heart then is spacious and able to connect, able to be interested, and to then care about another. And we go between being closed and struggling to being open and available and interested, and that's what it's like. And we all know that's what it's like. And we feel much better when we are open and connected and friendly. The Buddha talked about metta, loving kindness, this divine abiding as, I love this, a heart grown wide with loving kindness. It's like when we're not, when we're troubled, upset, etc., self-preoccupied, we're small. We're isolated in our own small state. When we're soothed and we're okay, we're actually way bigger. We have space for others. We're open. We become a sense of being much larger. We all know that. You know that's an experience we feel. You don't just feel calm or happy. You feel way bigger. So another description of this metta, loving kindness, and these Brahma Viharas is boundless. The boundless states. They're sometimes called the immeasurables. So large, that feeling that it's possible for the heart to feel so large, to feel so one with everything that it's immeasurable. It's boundless. It's a boundless state. And at times we can experience this ourselves in this. And it's not just words then. When we experience that feeling, we feel way beyond the boundary of what we thought we were, this little body with the skin around it. Anybody experience that today? Feeling bigger than usual? One of you. Oh, well, it's working then. Hmm. There are, and this is meant by way of reassurance. Again, I'm wanting to sort of demythologize the word love. There is love as a translation and a feeling, that feeling of great tenderness and connection can be really quite juicy. But also, there is a quieter, I prefer that word friendliness, as I was, he was explaining how we can get a little over-dramatic with the idea of love. Friendliness, the way we behave and the way we feel when with dear friends. But even cooler, even less what we think of as love, but still metta, is that spaciousness of heart that can allow things to be as they are and allow people to be as they are and not have to wish them to be different or to contend with stuff. It's a spaciousness of allowance. And that doesn't sometimes feel like love. Sometimes our idea of love is really turned on or really doing a lot or pouring out something. It's like, you know, big, powerful thing. But even just that quiet state that's okay with things, that's metta also. And there's an even cooler version that's still metta, which is a sense of being comfortable and able to tolerate what's unpleasant. Sometimes the word tolerance and the word patience are translated similarly. When you're patient with something, it doesn't mean wishing it would hurry up and be over but not complaining overtly. That's actually impatience. But real patience is being okay until it changes. Actually being able to be with the difficult thing. That's really patience. It's calm. It's fine. So another word is often used as tolerance, meaning I'm perfectly able to tolerate the situation. I don't like it. But it's what's happening. That even is metta. I may not love it at all. I may totally dislike it. But I'm not wishing it were different and having an agenda that's imposing on top of it. It's just, this is what's happening. That open ease with a situation. So it goes right from, you know, lovely, to being even unpleasant, but that's still metta. So I'm saying this so that you don't feel confused that you're trying to get something that's not happening and then say, oh, this is a bad sitting because I didn't feel very loving. Often we use metta, many times, the commonest time that people turn to metta or remember kindness is when we're upset. So really the most sort of popular time is as a soother, using metta to soothe the upset, to soothe the crying little one here who's struggling. It's a very, very skillful response when we're upset. One of the most easily accessible, skillful ways of dealing with any kind of upset. There are also other ways and other skills and understanding and spaciousness, equanimity, there's many others, but metta is extremely valuable whenever we're upset. Many of you have heard me say this, and you've probably heard Joanne say this before. Sylvia Borstein, one of our colleagues who teaches a lot of metta, habitually, whenever she's upset, she's trained herself to do this, and she does this routinely, and any time she's upset, she either does this out loud, physically, or else she visualizes herself doing it. She says, oh, sweetheart, you're upset. Oh, sweetheart, you're upset. Usually we don't. We're upset, and we are upset with something, and that's what we're looking at. That's something that's upsetting us. And the more we focus on that upsetting thing, the more we'll be upset. It's actually not very smart to look at what's upsetting ourselves. But to look instead and say, oh, I'm upset, this is hard. That right away is kind. It's like, oh, oh, this is difficult. That's a totally different response, and it completely reduces the fire right there. Because we're not like making it more by hating it or wishing it were different and trying to explain it or justify it or do anything to it. We're just not focusing on it. We're focusing on how hard it is. It's compassion, actually. That's a compassionate response. I should have brought my new little toy. I got something in the mail yesterday. It's actually really fun being a Vipassana teacher because you get little things in the mail sometimes. I was teaching a retreat in April down in the States, Washington State, and at that retreat there was somebody who just sent me this little gift in the mail yesterday, and in response to, with no note or anything, so I know what this was a response to, one of the ways I describe the way our minds work is that, it's a word that I like, is that the mind, our mind tends to glom onto things. It's the way we've survived as a race, and when things are nice, we glom onto the nice things, and we're all, you know, interested in accumulating them or getting more of them, or, oh, look at the flowers, aren't they lovely, glom. Or, oh, that's really yucky, you know, there's a creepy crawly that I don't like, the mind goes, it focuses on objects. We don't see the big picture. We take out of the big field the discrete objects which we either like or don't like. That's how we tend to function. It's how we've survived. It's an appropriate thing, but we do it exclusively. So we see things sort of out of context. And so this glomming on of the mind, I was describing as, and I was describing it as a toy that I had seen once, which was a, it's like a little sticky hand on a long, gooey, you know, and you just go like that, and it goes zip, and it sticks onto things. Well, I got it in the mail yesterday. I don't know, this man, this young man, was on that retreat, so I knew that was what he was sending me. He'd seen one. Well, this is what we do. So we notice, and we notice whether we like or we don't like, and then we proliferate that it's, you know, we judge and explain or justify or whatever, glorify the thing we're glomming onto. The skill of Vipassana meditation, as we learn it, is instead of glomming, is to look at what we're adding to the thing, to look at our contribution to our experience instead of just the thing which continues to trigger us. And with metta, we start with metta as we start with Vipassana, with things, because this is the way our glommy minds do it. So with Vipassana, we start with noticing our breath or noticing our body, noticing itching or a sound, the objects of our experience, because that's the untrained mind gloms. But as we practice more, we begin to, instead of paying full attention to the things that are coming to us, we notice how we're responding. Well, with metta, we begin with a person. Morris is my cat's name. He'd be a great object. Start with Morris. But as we practice, we begin to realize what we're noticing isn't just Morris and that we're wishing Morris well. We're actually noticing, I like Morris, except in spring when he sheds everywhere and when he produces guts all over the half landing of mice. In fact, what I start noticing is my response to Morris, more than Morris. Morris is a way to lead me into my own understanding of my own heart. The way the objects of Vipassana are what leads us to understand how our minds function. It's very clever. It's sort of sneaky. But that's how the practice is a wisdom practice, how we learn as we do the practice. We're not just trying to be loving and love Morris. It's way, way more profound than that. We discover way, way more than that. We discover it takes us to ourselves increasingly and to where we get caught and stuck and are anxious and where and when that subsides for a time. So then when Sylvia says, oh, sweetheart, you're upset, she's gone from glomming onto the thing that upset her right away. She's turned back to herself then. And that's what we learn as we do the practice. Because actually, we can't do anything about the things that are upsetting us. Sometimes a little bit. We like to fool ourselves that we can fix them and rearrange them, but actually, most of the things that happen are way beyond our control. But what we can do something about is how we meet them. Are we able to be at least accepting of them to some degree? That's what we can learn. That's the training where it takes us. So when we have a response to a difficult situation, for instance, that's a kind, compassionate response to ourselves. Oh, sweetheart, there you go, bitching again. We cannot add more judgment and pain on top of what we're already doing, something painful. We cheer ourselves up. It's a cheering ourselves up. I love that word, cheer. People don't use it anymore, but, you know, be of good cheer is kind of old-fashioned language. There's somebody on the island who is an older man now, and quite a lot of people know who he is. I'm not going to give his name. And when he's saying goodbye to you, he says, cheerio. I think that's the sweetest thing. It's falling out of fashion, but it's a very lovely way of meeting and greeting, you know. Cheer. Some people say, cheer up, love. They do that in England. They used to say that to me all the time when I was a kid. Cheer up, love. Walking down the road. It used to bug me because it sort of implied that I was miserable. But to be of good cheer is a beautiful wish. It's a metta wish. So it's actually one of the ways of helping ourselves with metta is to do things which cheer ourselves up. Metta itself cheers ourselves up, but we can actually do lovely things to cheer ourselves up. To walk in this beautiful nature, that's cheering. To forgive ourselves for stumbling yet again, that cheers us up. To remind ourselves that we're doing the best we can, for goodness sake, cheer yourself up. We tend to put ourselves down, don't we, so much. We get frustrated with ourselves. Oh, I'm never going to be able to get the hang of this. I thought I understood it, but it's hopeless. We're just so harsh. Would you like to have, who would volunteer to have half an hour of your inner commentator be displayed for everyone to hear? Would it be what you would actually say out loud and be happy to have said out loud? I mean, we just would never want to, because it's so critical, especially of ourselves, isn't it? We would never say that to somebody else the way we carry on with ourselves. That's not metta at all. I know I talked about that in the first evening last, it was only last night, wasn't it? It seems like oceans away, but I was speaking about the precepts and speech. And how do we speak? How do you speak to yourself? Oh, sweetheart, do you say? Or do you give yourself a kick in the shins? Come along. I was on retreat last year. I retreat in November as a general rule. So I was practicing in November. And I was practicing at my own home, which is just up the road. And, I don't know, 3 weeks into the retreat, like quite a long time, I was quite quiet. Suddenly something, I don't remember what it was that I thought, but some worrisome thought, something came into my mind. And I heard my inner dialogue say to myself, oh, darling, what do you need? I was completely astonished that that was the way I responded to myself. Because I really don't usually, I certainly don't call myself darling. And I thought, darling? You know, like, who says darling? I actually do talk to Morris with the word darling, I've now realized after that. But I was so shocked that I actually found myself saying to myself, not just darling, which is a very endearing kind of thing to say, extraordinary to say it to oneself, but actually it wasn't just, oh, darling, you'll need something. It was like, what do you need? Like, I was being so, you know, attentive of myself. My response to my upset was that obviously I was needing something and I was being very, very solicitous of myself. To actually have a natural response like that is, I was shocked, and I've been practicing for a long time. I guess I shouldn't be so shocked because we become nicer, even to ourselves. But that would be more of a meta kind of a response. It's a befriending. I was befriending myself. And we don't do that enough. And we discover how little we do that when we sit here and we listen to the inner dialogue. It's easy to do. It's just that we aren't habituated to be nice. We're more habituated to somehow be judgmental or full of high expectations and. But it's not a complicated thing. It's actually easy. There was used to be a bumper sticker a long time ago. Commit random acts of kindness and senseless acts of beauty. Do you remember? I haven't seen any for quite a few years. But what a sweet, like just random acts of kindness. In fact, I had a book once. I don't know if I bought it or was given it. And it was called Random Acts of Kindness. It was a little tiny book. And each page was, you know, put a pie on somebody's doorstep kind of things, like random things. It's the funnest thing. Well, just even thinking of doing little things like that is a very cheerful thing. That's metta. It's very easily metta. There's a little story, a book I have about ways to be happy and kind, and I don't remember what the title is, something about kindness. But full of all kinds of stories and anecdotes and so on. And this is just one that stuck with me, which I love. There was a story of a woman who lived in an apartment, and she shared her apartment, you know, the wall with the next apartment, with the bedroom of the next door people. And that in that bedroom, there was a young couple, and they had a little kid, a little toddler. And they used to put their little toddler to bed in that room right beside her living room, and then they'd shut the door and go and watch TV. And the little toddler cried herself to sleep many, many times. And this woman, didn't know what to do. She didn't know whether she should complain or blame them. They were a young couple, or even just let them know. Maybe they didn't know. She didn't really know them or what to do. But she realized pretty quickly that if she could hear this child crying herself to sleep night after night, then the child would be able to hear her. And so she would sing. And so she just sang this little child every night, whenever it was in there crying, and it would soothe itself and go to sleep with the warmth of friendliness instead of aloneness. It's a simple thing. So whenever you feel exhausted or flat or confused or worried or bitchy or any of these things, say to yourself, help, I need metta. And just say something kind to yourself. Oh, darling, what do you need? There's a teacher that, I don't know if you've mentioned him, you certainly have to me, but I can't remember if Joanna's mentioned him to people here in this retreat, whose name is Bhante, meaning an honorific, Gunaratana. He lives in West Virginia, but he's a Sri Lankan man and has been a monk for a long, long, long time. He's in his 80s now or something. He's an elderly man anyway. And he has said, somebody told me, I didn't hear him say this, but somebody, a student of his, told me that he said that many times he finds Westerners who come to him for the teachings of the Buddha, he finds they're so not loving to themselves that he won't teach them any kind of insight meditation training until they've done 2 years of metta for themselves. We're very much in need of self-acceptance and self-reassurance. I was pretty astonished to hear that. I mean, part sort of makes sense, but he made such a statement of that. So you're not alone in needing metta. Not alone in saying, help, I need metta. I've got a couple of other little bits and pieces to say. When we're doing the practice of metta, the one that we've taught about wishing well and counting blessings and sending blessings and your Tinkerbell showering blessings over and over and over and over and over, there isn't room in your mind for other things like self-blame. There will be in between because it's not, you know, like a solid wall of sound kind of thing. But when we are giving ourselves something like that to do, it's a very wholesome thing we're doing. We're generating whatever degree, not to compare and to judge how loud and juicy or how cool and quiet it is, we are being occupied with a wholesome activity. And in that moment, we're not planning revenge or judging. It's very simple, obvious, practical. It's a very more wholesome occupation for your mind to do some blessing than to do some complaining. Here's another little tiny story from that same book. A woman had been in a house fire, and she was badly burned, including dreadfully disfigured. Her face was very badly burned. And when it came time, after all the operations and the healing and everything, to take the bandages off, she didn't want to look. And she says that it was the presence of one of her dear friends who had enough caring and honesty, who could look at her and look at her face without flinching, that allowed her to look in the mirror. The friend wasn't doing anything, apparently, but she was being fully there for this person and able to face the difficulty. That, too, is metta. Because our habit is to run away from the difficulty or to try and explain things away or to numb down and all kinds of things. To be able to allow Okay, so it's scarred. To be able to allow herself to open to what was there, difficult as it would be, really helped the woman do that for herself. That's a huge gift. It's a very quiet gift, but it's a huge impact. And there's another little meta story. I love this little story. A woman was walking down the street and had an aneurysm and keeled over on the street of some city and passed out and, was on her way to dying. And there were people walking. It was in the city street. And the nearest person was a man who saw her stumble and bent down and to see what he was do. And then he saw her become unconscious. And so he knelt down right over her and he started to give her artificial respiration, and he was breathing breath into her, and she survived. And what happened is she left her body at that moment, and so she saw the whole thing, and she's up above, which can happen to people with near-death experiences. She was able to see herself lying on the ground, and she was able to see this man kissing life into her, this stranger. And she said, you know what brought me back? It wasn't the oxygen, it was his compassion. She said it was irresistible. When we do this practice, it has different effects on our lives. There are different fruits, different things occur when we do this training. Five things. One of them is when you do it over and over and over and over and over, the mind becomes collected and calm and settled. We call that concentrated. It's a concentration effect. And people who do it for long periods of time, many, many hours a day, day after day after day, have extremely concentrated experiences. Joanne was talking about her practice, 3 months of doing it, 2.5 months a day. The longest I practiced metta solidly was 1 month, but it's extraordinary how calm and quiet the mind can become by doing anything over and over and over. And metta works very well for that. It's one effect. Another effect because it's not just any old concentration practice, it's a practice of our heart and tuning into the state of your heart, is our hearts become way more tender. Way more vulnerable, and some of you even in a half a day were feeling very tender and very full of your own feelings about whatever's going on for you. You know the truth of that. It's a tenderizing practice. We become way more vulnerable than we're normally, sort of much more armored and withheld and so on. It's obvious. Another thing that happens, which is very close to that one, is with that tenderness, we become more connected to other people because we become more available. We're not so hiding behind our own protection, and so there's more space. There's connection that happens. Another thing that happens is that, and you have to sort of take this on faith because you already know those things that I just described, is that actually we get happier. Happiness comes. I don't know if anybody's experienced any bouts of happiness today. But it just sort of pops up at just the weirdest times, funny little things. And the more we take this practice, the more we do it from time to time in our lives, we get more happiness attacks. It's a delightful byproduct. It's why some people do it, because they just want to be happier, but it actually does work. It doesn't work the way we'd like it to work when we just say, okay, come on, cheer up. You know, it does it in its own time, in its own way, but definitely that's a side effect. And the fifth thing that happens is that we become wiser because, as you know, you start seeing the coverings and you see where you're stuck. And we've talked about that, both of us, on this retreat already, the purification that happens. And so it's a cleansing. It's a cleaning up. It's a de-junking. These are all hugely precious fruits of metta. The way they're taught, the way these Brahmaviharas are taught by the Buddha, very clever. Some of you know these, I'll just remind you. Loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity. In the teachings, it's described as these Brahmaviharas, or divine states, their opposites, which are fairly obvious, love or hate, compassion or cruelty, joy or misery, I don't know, whatever. Equanimity or disturbance and upset.
I know. Exuberance.
No, that's the near enemy.
Oh, near enemies.
I was thinking far enemies, but I'll get to the near enemies. But never mind. But what's very brilliant about the way the Buddha taught these is that there are near enemies, not just the opposite thing. In fact, most of our time, we may think that we're being metta-like, but oftentimes we're not quite metta-like. We're sort of close, but pretending. It's a kind of masquerading of the real thing. We've fallen a little short of true, pure, wise metta. With metta, the first one, the loving kindness, the near enemy, this is really useful because it's so easy to recognize this when it's explained in this way. The near enemy to love or metta, it's not quite it, is attachment. So when you really like something, the normal, untrained human doesn't just like it, it gets attached. It wants it. It's bummed out when it doesn't have it, or it leaves, or it can't get it. There's a hunger there. There's a wanting. Metta isn't attached. It can love, and the loved one, as Joanne was talking about this afternoon, it's not conditioned on that the loved one is nice, or likes you back, or even knows who you are. It's just simply a much more unconditioned, no strings attached kind of friendliness. To befriend something that doesn't respond to you at all. You know, I don't think the spiders care in my house whether I suck them up down the vacuum cleaner or not, other than they'd probably like to live longer. They don't like me because I'm keeping them out of the vacuum cleaner, in other words. So it's an unconditional caring. But our common state over something that we like is we've got strings attached, very much so. It's a kind of commercial arrangement. And when that doesn't work, as we know very well, when somebody doesn't do what we'd like them to do, we stop liking them even. And so metta is limited. You don't? So that's the near enemy. It's a very skillful way of looking at this, because more of the time we are attached than we are unconditionally friendly. We're conditionally friendly. Because there's a lot of ego in there. It's useful. The compassion one, the near enemy of compassion, is pity. So somebody is having a hard time, and we really pity them. Oh, the poor thing. But there's a bit of aversion with that. It's like, yuck, don't get too close. I don't want to catch it. You know, like, oh, poor you. We kind of look down on them or something, or we're afraid of it somehow. You know, or we have some argument against it. Somebody's upset, so they're ill, and, you know, like, why didn't they tell you this sooner? There's somebody should have diagnosed this differently, or, you know, that all of these things. They're actually to try and keep away a bit from that suffering. Pure karuna, compassion, isn't avoiding in any way. It's just with. Compassion, feeling with, Latin. Appreciative joy. Several near enemies, but one of the near enemies is exuberance, is not just being happy with another's happiness, but like, I think of exuberance as feasting off it, like getting attached to the happiness itself, getting overexcited,
and forgetting
the person.
The reason for it
is the person. Your heart is, you know, so you just get, oh, wonderful. Let's all celebrate and let's all get drunk together, isn't it? Yahoo! That kind of thing. That's a near enemy of appreciative joy. Appreciative joy is you still care about that person. You don't get carried away by the celebration. And equanimity, very useful. The near enemy of equanimity, the fourth of these, is indifference. When we're in a balanced, calm state, a lot of people get confused about this one. They think Buddhists don't care anymore. They stop being activists and they're all sort of beige and everything's just blah and it's all sort of all right and so what? And that's actually not equanimity. Equanimity is an open-hearted caring, but not being disturbed by or hating the unpleasant or getting attached to the pleasant. But so undisturbed but still really caring. Indifferent is dismissive and turning away from and disconnecting. It's not disconnected, it's connected without being reactive. It's non-reactive. Make of that what you will. At some point you might want to ponder that one. It's very, very useful. Mm. few things I want to say that are just supportive of this practice, the practice itself, but there are other aspects which really help us to tune into the heart and be able, because sometimes we can't just do straight metta, particularly it's challenging and we're having a hard time. So there are other ways to get to a tender heart, which all are sort of in the same family. Some of which the Buddha recommended in a classical way. One of them is to reflect on your own goodness. And it's kind of not our puritanical culture to do. But to actually say to yourself, you know, I'm actually an okay person. I'm decent kind of, I don't lie, I don't cheat, I don't deceive people deliberately. I mean, I have my warts and I have my shortcomings and I never was the most patient person actually, but I'm still pretty decent, you know, like I'm a virtuous person, I don't go around breaking vows, and it's actually really, really helpful to appreciate yourself once in a while. Just that, doing it that way, can relax you and calm you down and soften you, and then it's easier to wish yourself well. And yesterday, last evening when we first began, Joanne said, let's start with forgiveness. Because if you're holding something against somebody, you can't be loving towards them. You need to do that first. So forgiveness is a really useful way of entering into a tenderness, which can then be actually giving blessings. Another one, which is a lovely one, I find really, really helpful, is just to count your blessings. Just to be grateful. Just like, we have so many things to be grateful for. When we feel grateful, it reminds us actually our cup is half full or three quarters full. You know, not what we don't have, but what we do have. And that softens and soothes and reassures us. And then it's easier to be kind. The beauty of nature. All retreat centers are in beautiful nature. I don't know one retreat, well, I guess there's the occasional retreat center. There's one in Manhattan somewhere. People who live there who have a center, but many retreat, or you go away from the urban center and usually to some beautiful part of the world, and it's healing just being in nature, and that calms and soothes, reassures, and it's easier to be loving, easier to be friendly. They're really useful. Humor is like really very important. A little lightheartedness. You can't be kind if you're upset. You can't just often go straight to being doing metta. You need cheering up first. So humor is a good thing. Not at other people's expense, but humor is a good thing. Sometimes I read jokes at Dharma talks on gladdening the heart, but I don't have any today. Have to imagine your own humor. And another which is really, really useful, both for insight and understanding and for metta, is to, especially when you're dealing with somebody who you don't feel very friendly towards, who's a little challenging, is to remember, which gets easier the more we do it, the more we see this way, is to remember the fact that there are so many conditions causing this moment, and this person, irritating as they may be, they're this way because of all the things that have happened to them in their lives. The food they eat, the people they know, the pain they experience, the parentage they had, the teachers they've had, the ads they have to suffer through, all of it makes them that way. And when we remember that, it also makes me my way. It's allowing, it's forgiving. It doesn't make it great, but it makes us have some space for it. It's that friendliness. So remembering conditionality. Everything is conditioned. Nothing's just standing alone, just being yucky for the sake of it. It's simply a product of everything that's gone to create it. How could it be otherwise? And that's soothing. It relaxes the heart. So you stop that, like, if only it were not this way. Well, it can't help but be this way. As Sylvia Borstein says, it may be awful, but it's lawful. Thomas Merton, be kind to each person you meet, because each has been asked to carry a great burden. You have no idea what people are going through. And you have your opinion about somebody, and then you get to know them, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh my goodness me, Well, of course. And that's true for everybody. It's a very touching thing for us in the situation we're in here, and we talk to you, and we hear you, and you come and you share your stuff with us, and we find out what's going on. We go, oh my goodness. What people's lives are like. What we all have to deal with. You wouldn't believe it. Just in this one room, here's less than 50 people, there are some extraordinary stories of what people are dealing with right now. And when we know we have some space and we can hear what's going on, we automatically have more friendliness. It's so easy to take things at face value and to have our opinions. We just don't have enough information a lot of the time. We're all trudging along with as much dignity, courage, and style as we possibly can, says Hafez, a Persian poet. Let's see. A couple of quotes to finish with. Thomas Merton again. When he had quite a spiritual awakening very soon before he died in Sri Lanka. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, the depths of their hearts, where neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge can reach, the core of their reality, the person that each one is in the eyes of the divine. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time, there would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other. Hafez, I love Hafez, those of you who know me know this, contemporary of Rumi's, Persian mystical poet. First, he looked confused, it's called. I couldn't lie anymore, so I started to call my dog God. First he looked confused, then he started smiling, then he even danced. I kept at it, now he doesn't even bite. I'm wondering if this might work on people. I think I'll end with that one. No, there's one more, also Hafez. Out of a great need, we are all holding hands and climbing. Not loving is letting go. Listen, the terrain around here is far too dangerous for that. We'll just sit quietly for a couple of moments, let those words settle down.